Today, he recalls some of the adventures involved in taking on one of the roles for which he is best remembered, the accident-prone Frank Spencer.
It was, I understood, only after Norman Wisdom and Ronnie Barker had both turned down the role of Frank Spencer in Some Mothers Do Have 'Em that anyone thought of offering it to me. The show's producer, Michael Mills, was exactly the right man for such a project. He was a great one for adventure, willing to try absolutely anything. He could be brusque and even domineering. But without him and his kind of drive, I doubt Some Mothers would ever have worked. It was an outrageous farce, built around the kind of stunts and situations one used to see in old silent films, and in Frank Spencer, we attempted to create a modern-day silent film character. I've always felt that the reason the show worked so well was because Frank was portrayed as a real human being rather than just a figure of fun. Indeed, I believe that the warm, positive qualities of Frank Spencer really do exist in Raymond Allen, the young man who wrote Some Mothers. He was a kind, very gentle person, and for the life of me, I can't imagine how he ever found his way into the fiercely competitive world of television. He and Michael Mills were an odd couple, but perhaps it was those very differences that made them such a successful team. Michael, Raymond and I set about creating Frank's character. We made him a study in physical and mental anarchy, hilariously accident-prone, the ultimate klutz and eternal underdog. His voice sounded like that of a nasal 10-year-old, and his every sentence seemed to end on a note of shocked disbelief. He was a walking malaprop, too. "I don't know to what you are alluring." The final physical touches were provided by our costume designer, Michael Robbie, who dressed Frank in an odd assortment of mismatched jumpers, a shabby raincoat, and, in an inspired stroke, an old beret, which became the Spencer trademark. We even gave Frank his own complete and silly personal history. He was born, prematurely, in a cinema. Frank. "The Spencers haven't been on time for 5 generations. My grandfather was 3 weeks premature, my mother was early, and I was very immature myself. She was watching a John Wayne film." Betty. "Well, what happened, Frank?" "I don't remember." "Oh, I think he got killed in the end."
Frank was a bachelor in our first few scripts, but I thought it was crucial to make him a married man, and of course he'd need a wife who was extraordinarily caring, patient and understanding. Someone who believed in him absolutely, no matter how wacky his behaviour. Otherwise he would appear too bizarre to be credible. The role of Frank's long-suffering wife, Betty, finally went to Michelle Detrice. She was a natural comedienne, and the series owed a lot of its success to her talent. Michelle is a joy to play opposite. She has pluck and generosity and great humour, and I don't believe we ever stopped laughing. Whenever we rehearsed together, she'd make sure we did it somewhere near the loo. I love to tell of one Christmas episode in which Frank and Betty participate in a Christmas pageant. Michelle played the Virgin Mary, and I was dressed up as an angel of the Lord, complete with wings and a wire halo. The script required that I be pulled up by one of the crew to dangle high over the audience on a flywire. On the day of filming, our technician, who'd been having his own private Christmas party, practically cut me in half when he hoisted me up on the wire. Then he abruptly let the wire go and dropped me, but recovered just in time to catch me before I actually hit the floor. I had just enough wind left in me to bleat an ad-lib. "Well, that's ruined my Christmas." And the entire studio exploded in laughter. I bounced on my wire in equally uncontrollable laughter, and when I glanced over at Michelle in her Virgin Mary costume, I could see that, in addition to collapsing in hysterics, she'd also wet her light blue cassock. In the midst of all this pandemonium, Michael Mills swooped down from the production booth, pouncing on both the cast and the audience like a teacher scolding his pupils. He reminded us that television was a damn serious business and warned the audience that their howling response would only encourage more such pranks. In the retake, the audience, having been thoroughly chastened, didn't make a peep, no laughs, nothing. Michael dashed out of the booth again, pulling out his beard. "When I said television was serious, that's not what I meant." On the third take, both cast and audience finally got it right. The episodes surrounding the arrival of Betty and Frank's baby were among the highest rated in BBC history. They marked a reunion with John D. Collins. He'd been my roommate in my Nottingham Rep days, in the role of young Dr. Boyd, who is unwillingly roped into delivering the baby. John laughed so much during rehearsal that he told me on the day of the recording he'd actually gone to church the night before to pray he wouldn't break up during the show. I remember a particular line of John's. His face was inches from mine when he said it. "I've been to see your wife, and she's been telling me you don't come as often as you ought to." I didn't answer. I just looked at him, mystified, my mouth pursed in an aggrieved, "Oh." Then I looked away, then back again. I must have done a minute's worth of business, looking up at him, looking at him sideways, nose to nose all the while. There were beads of perspiration breaking through on his brow. He wasn't going to last much longer. I finally said, "But I've had a bit of trouble."
"You've had some trouble?" he asked.
"Yes," I answered him. "But I can..."
Beep.
His doctor's beeper, just millimetres from my face, went off. I've no idea how we managed to get through the scene without completely doubling up. The real-life adventure of one of our crew members was used as the basis for a very popular episode. An amateur rugby player sent in the true story of how he and his team had been driving along a cliff road when they discovered one of our film editors stranded precariously on the edge of the cliff. He'd been having a picnic in his car, and during a rainstorm, the back wheels of the vehicle slipped over the side of the cliff. Miraculously, his front wheels were maintaining a tentative hold on the top. Thankfully, the rugby team reached him in the nick of time. It made a perfect Frank Spencer story. This is how it appeared in the episode. Frank and Betty are caught in a sudden rainstorm on the cliffs, and Frank exclaims, "I think we're stuck. Don't look down. We're over the edge of the cliff. I'll get out and climb on the roof and get the manure out of the car." You see, he's a manure salesman at the moment and has sacks and sacks of the stuff in the boot. For the stunt gag, I had to get onto the roof of the car, slide headfirst into a somersault over the boot, and wind up hanging onto the bumper over the side of the cliff. Then, with one hand, I had to open the boot and pull the bags of manure out, which of course covered me as they fell down into the sea below. We found a fabulous location at Swanage, on a cliff hundreds of feet above the English Channel. A mini miner was rigged on the edge for the stunt sequence. Railway sleepers were built into the cliff edge, and joints welded onto the bottom of the car to act as hinges. The crew had complete control over the car's movements. I was wired to the back fender. Michelle was up on the car roof with me. She was as game as the best stuntman. I've always admired her pluck in doing this stunt hundreds of feet above the coast. But her mother vowed never to speak to me again for getting her involved in it. It was a complicated scene to film. There were cameras stationed everywhere. Under the cliff, on top of the cliff. We even had a camera equipped with a zoom lens set on a boat far out to sea. The Coast Guard had all kinds of calls that day from other ships reporting a car on the edge of the cliff with someone dangling from it. That scene remains one of my all-time favourites. I did some fairly wild stunts in some mothers, but whether I'm roller skating under a lorry, being dragged by a train, or bouncing down a flight of stairs inside a wardrobe, success is all in the planning, the control, and knowing how to hang on for grim death. There was, however, one notable exception when a crucial part of a stunt had to be done without the benefit of any rehearsal. The idea was to have Frank Spencer in training to be a window cleaner. I was lowered over the top and down the side of a building, along with Derek Ware, our top stuntman, who was playing my trainer. We stood in one of those window cleaner cradles, a steel container approximately 7 feet long and 3 feet in depth. It had a rail about 3 feet off the base, which you held onto as you leant in to clean the windows. The cradle slid up and down the building, operated by a series of push buttons in a metal box in the middle of the handrail. The visual joke had a very nervous Frank, who is afraid of heights, starting to clean a window. Then, glancing over his shoulder to see just how high he is, we were about 200 feet off the ground, Frank's nerves get the better of him, and he jumps back in fright, getting his foot caught in the water bucket. His foot then shoots up in the air, flipping the bucket over the edge of the window cleaner's cradle to the car park below, where it smashes through the windscreen of the boss's car. Now, absolutely terrified, he starts to struggle with the other window cleaner. "I want to get out," he cries. "I'm afraid of heights. I want to get out." With that, the script called for me to fall over the edge of the cradle and hang on to the outside, pulling the other man with me so that we both end up hanging 20 stories above the street. A rope with a wire inside had been attached to me, allowing for a fall of about 5 feet below the cradle. The script called for Derek, who was wired independently of me, to land on my shoulders when he fell. We had never actually been able to rehearse in the cradle high above the street, and on the day of filming, when we went into our falls, our combined weight pulled the cradle down, made it tip, and wedge itself into the runners on the building wall. We were completely stuck. It couldn't go up or down, and so we hung helpless on the outside of the cradle, 200 feet above London's North Circular Road. The only sound was the creak of the wires as they twisted, first one way, then the other. Hardly daring to whisper, I said, "Get them to get on the radio and pull us up." I didn't even want to move my jaw. I was terrified that the slightest movement would send us plunging to our deaths. In the distance, I could see Wembley Stadium, then Harlesden, the north end of the Edgware Road, and beyond that, Marble Arch. And then we'd slowly twist back again. After what seemed an endless 20 minutes, the crew managed to lower someone down in an attempt to pull us back into the cradle. But the rescue was only partially successful. The stuntman was brought up off my shoulders, but now with the rescuing party, there were too many people in the cradle. So I had to continue to hang for another 20 minutes. Perhaps that doesn't sound such a very long time, but trust me, it was a very long time.